Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. How are you today?
Doing great. Good talking with you.
I got the vibe earlier. We were chatting before that maybe your head's not in the game today. Maybe you just need to get a vacation. You seem a little confined by the Beltway swamp, and you need to get out. Are you ready to play today?
Well, of course, I always bring the A game, Bill. You're talking about our pre-game interview. People don't realize that we spend hours and hours prepping for this. And I mentioned I'm, ready to head out of town here in a couple weeks, get out of the swamp. You know, it's a tough time of year. You try to write, you try to promote stuff, and a lot of people have tuned out, so it's a little frustrating. But I think, you know, part of being a writer and keeping things fresh and interesting is to occasionally get away from it and read, replenish the, you know, recharge the battery, replenish the well of information, and don't write for a while. And so I'm looking forward to that. And I am I think I'm overdue for a good break.
Well, I don't think you're on fumes right now. I saw what you wrote this week about the Republican primary being akin to an NCAA college basketball Final Four bracket. I thought that was a nice rethinking of how presidential politics works. I didn't get the sense that you are, again, running. I don't think you're running on fumes right now. I think you're still in a good groove.
Well, Bill, even when I'm on 70 or 80%, it's still, let's be honest, it's still pretty kick-ass. No, but look, this column essentially argues that the way that 2016 is going to shape up, and it's a little different than 2012, but the way 2016 is going to shake up is essentially you're going to have to win your bracket to advance. And so everybody's talking about the battle between Rand Paul and Chris Christie, but the truth is that the road, if that clash happens, and it is a serious debate about security versus liberty, but before that clash happens in earnest, before those two men have the chance to face off, each has to sort of win their division. And I argue that Rand Paul has to get by Ted Cruz to corner the market on the libertarian populist brand, and that Chris Christie has to get by Marco Rubio because they're going to be competing for the same votes and the same money. And essentially the point here is if you're an informed consumer of campaign information, don't buy the hype and don't look. Here's how you don't want to think about it. Don't think of it as like a chronological, the top 10 people who are going to run, and number one chance is Christie, number two is Rubio. That's not really true. You have to win your division. So think of it in a sports context. You know, before the wild card, you could be the second best team in baseball, but you wouldn't make it to the playoffs if the Yankees were in your division. So that's sort of the way to think about it. I think it's you've got to win your bracket to advance. Check out the column. But that is the kind of stuff I'm writing about these days. As I look forward to the race.
No, I think that's the right way to look at it. But by the same token, I don't think it makes the cross back bracket skirmishing irrelevant. I mean, right now this is coming up because Chris Christie is taking swipes at Rand Paul. Christie is going in the establishment bracket, and Paul is in the libertarian bracket. They're not in your setup. They're not directly competing against each other, at least not yet, because they're not in the final two. But Christie needs to show that he's ready for the final two. That if you're worried about Rand Paul being the nominee, if you're in that establishment camp or the corporate camp or whatever, and you think Rand Paul is going to be suicide for the Republican Party, you want to put up someone who's going to take him down. And so you got to show your mettle that you're ready to take him down, and you're not pussyfooting around him. Whereas if Christie was going to take swipes at Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, which are not going to be about big ideological things, they're going to be about ticky-tack stuff, you know, that might make you look very petty, very political, And my question might raise questions about, you know, do you have the right motivations entering into this contest? Right now, Christians position themselves, I'm going to save the Republican Party from this insidious libertarian virus that's going to destroy our national security bona fides, as is, to a lesser extent, Congressman Pete King is suggesting he wants to do also. So you're seeing this battle brewing. And so I don't think you dismiss that aspect of the contest, even though you're correct that Christie needs to show he's better than these other establishment picks before he can advance to the next stage.
Right. Well, first of all, as I said earlier, I think it is a huge debate taking place on the right, this argument about, and we saw it with the NSA, the vote whether or not to fund the NSA, the Justin Amash amendment last week. So it's the context is it's a real debate. It's a serious debate. It's a debate worth having. And I think that Christie can use, this is also a little bit of a game, that Christie can use Rand Paul, attack Rand Paul, to buttress his argument as being the national security establishment candidate. But make no mistake, Chris Christie's real enemy, his existential threat, is not Rand Paul. It is Marco Rubio. And make no mistake, Rand Paul's real enemy, for now at least, is not Chris Christie, it is Ted Cruz. And that's where the real action is.
Now, I have a quibble with you. I'm not as convinced that there is this blood fight going on between Paul and Cruz yet. I have the sense that Paul is clearly way ahead in the presidential contest in his organizing and name recognition than Cruz is. I'm not fully convinced that Cruz is even going to run. If he does run, how serious he would get, he would invest himself in it, or how serious he's able to invest himself in it. If Rand Paul really has, locked up, the Tea Party rank and file. So, if Cruz does not run, then in going through your bracket theory, Rand Paul gets a bye. He's seated number one in the bracket. He doesn't have to do the first round. Or perhaps he's going to be seated one in Cruz of 16. That's going to be very easy to dispatch of him. But that would be, if that's the case, that would be highly unusual to be a broken record myself on this subject. It would be unusual because usually the folks who are more on the ideological fringe of the primary, there's usually several of them. They usually beat each other up. The rank and file gets too attached to their absolute precious favorite, and they can't just consolidate around one choice. And so while that aspect of the party fractures and splinters, usually the establishment consolidates around one, Mitt Romney, John McCain, Bob Dole, and they are able to push off any kind of threat from the far right. As it stands today in the current polling, only Rand Paul pulls double digits out of that bracket, and everyone else is splintering amongst establishment types. So I think there's a chance. I would say it's a huge chance. But if Cruz realizes, hey, I can't beat this guy, I agree with him on almost everything. So I don't need to beat him. I'm only 41, 42 years old. I got plenty of time. Why don't I just be Rand Paul's wingman here and let him have a good run at it? If that's the case, I think Rand Paul is going to be very well positioned to get the nomination. If Rand Paul gets dragged down to a dogfight with Cruz, there's not a lot of evidence that a bloody fight on the far right leads to a far right nominee. It does not usually happen that way. Usually it means the establishment has time to get their act together and push those guys off the edge. So I we'll see if Cruz thinks about it in selfish terms or in ideological terms before he makes this decision. But you think he's more of a threat, it seems.
Well, number one, what about these guys would ever lead you to believe that they're not in a hurry and that they're willing to be somebody's wingman? There's nothing about their behavior that would ever lead you to believe that. I think Cruz is a very serious candidate, and I think he's Rand Paul without the baggage. He's Rand Paul without the liberty. Don't get me wrong. The Ron Paul, the ardent Ron Paul fan is with Rand and cannot be moved. But if you're sort of a grassroots conservative Tea Party guy who wants to burn down Washington, I think either of these guys are more than acceptable to you. And then the question is, which guy can win? And I think Rand Paul has a lot of baggage to overcome.
So I take him serious.
But look, I think that there aren't going to be any buys. So I don't think there's a buy. I think you have to fight to be the populist libertarian candidate. I think there'll be a fight to be the sort of establishment, serious conservative candidate. And then I think there's going to be a third bracket I call the wild card, where you could see someone emerge. There's always a surprise, right? Whether it's Huckabee or Santorum, somebody makes it into the final round that was a surprise. And I think there you could have a Mike Pence or a Scott Walker who sort of straddles the establishment populist dichotomy emerge.
Well, usually when you have that wild card, that usually is good for the establishment candidate. And anything that divides the right is usually good for the establishment. So if you have that one emerging, that's going to take some chunk out. I mean, if it's any kind of libertarian, a Cruz or a Rand Paul, that's a pretty fringy candidate to have as a presidential nominee. You got to really get everything's got to line up just right if you're going to eventually get to 35% in early contests and get close to 50% in the later contests. Anything that cuts into that is a major problem for you. So if that happens, it's a major problem for them. I think Rand right now is polling, you know, high teens, 20 in national polling amongst Republican primary voters, which is not enough as it is, but no one is polling all that much better right now, so he's okay as it stands. So if you are, you know, hardcore Tea Party libertarian, but not, you know, a Rand Paul worshiper, and maybe you're willing to cast around to an extent, you know, it's still going to be very appealing, one, to look at the polls and say, hey, if I want to burn down Washington, Rand Paul actually has a shot of doing it for once. You know, maybe I just got to get on that bandwagon because he's so far out ahead here. And two, to the extent you hear all these questions about his baggage and how he's unelectable, you know, there's a weird reverse psychology going on with the Tea Party right now, where, you know, someone like Karl Rove says this guy is absolutely toxic, and then you say, screw you, Karl Rove, you don't know what you're doing. You've been ruining this party for 10 years now. I'm going to do the exact opposite of what you tell me to do. So how do you stop that thinking? And stop Rand Paul. But he needs to have that clear head of steam for it to keep going forward. You know, if Ted Cruz really wants to, you know, lay into him, that would be a problem for him.
Yeah, look, first of all, I think that any of these four, and there are a lot of candidates. I mean, Jeb Bush might run. He would obviously be in the establishment bracket. But I think that whether it's Christie, Rubio, Paul, or Cruz, I think it's entirely plausible that any of them could be the nominee. Some, I think, have a better chance than others, but it's not impossible. I don't pay any – you keep talking about early polling. I think it's largely irrelevant at this point. And it exists in a vacuum. You know, what happens when Rand Paul when people are talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Aqua Buddha and the Southern Avenger, and
he can handle Aqua Buddha. I think that one's been beaten back.
I think you're probably right, but my point is there's a lot of baggage, there's a lot of stuff that that can and will be said about Rand Paul. And if you really want to stop Chris Christie, or if you really want to stop Hillary Clinton, then I think Rand Paul becomes a little more vulnerable. We'll see how he manages it. I think he could win. I mean, look, again, he finds a way to win Iowa, and it's who knows from there.
Santorum, who essentially won Iowa last time, you didn't know it till several weeks later. I mean, he got like what, 26%? You know,
how many votes are you? If like a few thousand people in Davenport or something decide, you know, the next president potentially. I mean, the Republicans haven't really, Iowa hasn't been that big of a springboard on the Republican side, but certainly Barack Obama used it, catapulted him.
Well, I mean, you got to win something early. And then you got to start stringing something together. So, I mean, if you know, if you have different winners of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, then that portends a dogfight, you know, going forward. You know, you have this weird situation in 2012 where Iowa was kind of an odd tie, but Romney got the headline coming out of it, and he won New Hampshire, and then he lost South Carolina, which made things a little uneasy for a time, but it wasn't enough to fully derail what Romney had going. But you can't get shut out of those first three in January. You got to win the early rounds.
Yeah.
But you can win early round with you know, in some cases 25, more likely 35. You don't need the whole thing. You just need to consolidate your faction. If Rand Paul can, so all the things you throw at Rand Paul, so long as Rand Paul doesn't have other distractions within his bracket, he could consolidate that. But obviously, he's going to have to answer to all of these past comments and past hires.
Sure.
And so forth.
But my point is, once, and it's early now, obviously, but once you really start competing, let's say in Iowa, let's say Rand Paul decides he could win Iowa and New Hampshire. Think of that. Rand Paul, it's not absurd to think he can do that. I'm not predicting it, but it could happen. So let's say Rand Paul decides we're going to win Iowa. All right, who's his biggest problem in Iowa? It's not Rubio or Christie. And that's when this thing gets ugly. And I'm telling you, turf warfare and internecine struggles are the ugliest usually. And it's when you're fighting for turf and you're fighting against the person that is the most similar to you, that used to be your friend maybe, that it gets really ugly. And I'm just saying that will be interesting to see. I predict that it will happen. We can talk all we want about these huge clashes between Christie and Paul, but predictably the first tests of when the race begins in earnest are going to be these fighting to occupy a niche. And remember, in 2008, Michelle Bachmann was friendly. In 2012, Michelle Bachmann was very friendly to Mitt Romney. Now, who did she attack? Rick Perry. She attacked him for the HPV vaccine stuff. She attacked him for in-state tuition. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney, you know, the author of Obamacare, oh, he's fine. He's a good guy. Same thing with Ron Paul.
The person who attacked Romney and Obamacare first was Tim Pawlenty, who was angling for the establishment bracket.
Exactly.
And then once that cut a little too close, they thought, well, maybe this is going to hurt my standing within the establishment circles. Maybe I'll back off a little bit. But his initial inclination was, I got to take out the guy in my bracket before I can advance. Yeah.
You've got to. So that's what I'm saying. And if you want to be an educated consumer of campaign information and you want to impress somebody at the bar, then drop this idea. Print out the brackets.
To that point, we had a show back in May about what, and I'd read an article in the week about this. You know, that if Rand Paul does get the nomination, he could get the nomination. I mean, this is at a time where people weren't even taking Rand Paul seriously. I said, look, the early polling shows he could be the nominee. That is not a crazy possibility right now.
It's not absurd. Not absurd.
And secondly, if he was the nominee, he could well be the last Republican nominee because his foreign policy views are so anathema to the national security wing of the party that they could just walk. And I talked about John McCain. He had been giving speeches saying that he was closer to a Barack Obama on foreign policy than some in his party, calling for Republicans to be new internationalists and stand up against the libertarians and the isolationists. And I even said, you know, they might have a place to go in 2016, whether if they want to either just, you know, sit on their hands or start a third party, or temporarily leave and back Hillary and start Republicans for Hillary. And some people, and you and I talk about that seriously, and some people said that we were trolling. They were just looking for clickbait and bringing up wild hypotheticals to get under people's skin and cause so division. But now the New Republic did an interview with John McCain just this week, and they asked him point blank, if it's Rand versus Hillary, who do you choose? And McCain said, that's a tough choice, chuckle, 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 which is a clear indication that he would go with Hillary because he's been lashing against Rand Paul for a while now.
or at least to be open to the possibility, which is what we were saying, which, again, wisdom before is conventional. Folks, look, if you are a fan of this show, I urge you to pick up the phone now and make a donation to the Human Fund. I just want to say you're not wasting your time. We occasionally are ahead of the curve on stuff. And this is a prime example, Bill, of and there are others. We could talk about others. But this is a prime example. We were 3 or 4 months out in advance of this, and they called us crazy. And here we have confirmation that, yes, once again, we knew what we were talking about. So,
And this was a time in May where McCain was still on his high horse on Benghazi. It wasn't that far after he had grilled Hillary in the Senate about Benghazi. This was before he had been doing the deals with Obama over filibuster reform and before the immigration bill actually got through the Senate. So it seemed odder then. But the fact is, if you've been following McCain for a long time, you know how seriously he takes foreign policy and national security. You know, that is like his absolute, you know, bedrock mission in public service to advance his foreign policy vision. And it's just between Hillary and Rand. I'm not saying Hillary's a neoconservative. She's not. But the fact that she is accepting, as is Barack Obama, of the use of military force to advance some interests. I mean, I think, you know, Obama and Hillary diverge with McCain on how wide a range of interests military might should be used for. But there's more overlap there than there is with McCain and Rand. So it was not hard to foresee.
Yeah.
McCain
and we talked, the and we talked about this, and we talked about this on the show. Could it happen? You know, you have to wonder, there'd be a backlash. I mean, there's certainly a wing of on the left who wouldn't be happy if Hillary sort of became the hawk and welcomed in the John McCain.
There are folks not happy now.
But I would say this. Imagine the coup. If she pulled that off, you would have gone from, as recently as like 5 years ago, you know, the Democrats were still seen as the weak dove party that you can't trust on national security, that you can't trust on law and order. And that had been a narrative plaguing them for at least a generation.
Well, since McGovern.
And if this happened, and I don't think we're predicting that it's going to happen, but I do think we're gloating about the fact that our prediction that it could happen has been confirmed, at least that it's at least plausible has been confirmed. But if that happened, wow, that would be a reordering of the, you know, political paradigm, of the partisan paradigm.
It would, maybe historians look back and say, look, when the Cold War ended, such a reshuffling was preordained. Yeah, was because there are obviously different challenges and issues at play, and the parties were not perfectly aligned. The parties had to both go through some internal machinations to readjust to the new reality. And Rand Paul, you could argue, is you know, right place, right time for him to say, look, we should have a new Republican Party to deal with the world as it stands today, and not be stuck in a Cold War mentality. But you can't expect a John McCain to want to sit there and like it. He has his own agency. He can do what he wants. And there have been plenty of times when these sorts of paradigm shifts happen that people pick up their bags and move. And sometimes it's temporary. Sometimes it's just, you know, Democrats for Nixon, and it's a one timer, and they go back to the fold afterwards. And sometimes it's a temporary split, like Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, but it heals 4 years later when they reunite in face of a common enemy. And sometimes it's like the Whigs, and they just die, and they reorganize in different places somewhere else. So, I mean, Rand is a major threat to the old Republican order, and I can't see the Republican order just sort of sitting there and accepting it. If he's the nominee, things are going to change.
It'd be fascinating to watch, but again, the big takeaway here is we were right, and we deserve You were really at the forefront of this, but
you know, and just to pat myself on the back again, you know, a few weeks ago I said, look, right after the filibuster deal, John McCain is emerging as the linchpin to whether or not Obama has a successful second term or not. You know, if he's going to get anything through Congress now, you know, McCain's going to be in the middle of it, and he's showing a willingness to be in the middle of it. And now you're seeing a bunch of other you're seeing the Politico jumped on that bandwagon 2 weeks later, teasing out how McCain has actually been in very close contact with the White House as of late. The fact that this New Republic interview is because New Republic is recognizing what a central figure McCain is being. And I think it's McCain recognizing, you know, history is going to look at you either as a bitter, petty loser who turned his back on his own issues in the face of his defeat from Obama, or someone who shook off a tough loss and say, you know, I care about these issues. I care about immigration. I care about the institution of the Senate. I care about foreign policy. There are things I can work with Obama on, and I'm gonna suck it up and do it. And that's where he seems to be at right now. And you know, if Obama gets immigration through, which would probably be the biggest legislative thing he could get done in the second term, it's going to be in large part because of John McCain. The fact that Obama's Wall Street reform has been protected from being in legal limbo because of the recess appointment of Richard Cordray might have been struck down by the Supreme Court soon, and that would have called into question all the rulemaking that he's done up until this point. That's now not a problem because Cordray is now affirmed through traditional process. If Obama's going to have workplace rights expanded through the NLRB, which they tried to do a year ago and got struck down by the court because they lacked a proper quorum, now they have a proper quorum because McCain cut the deal for nominations. So these are not, this is not just a bit of housekeeping. It's not just about Senate rules and process. It's actually going to be a major boon to Obama's legacy.
Well, we must be lucky with McCain, though. I remember a young Matt Lewis in the summer of 2007. Picture it, Arlington, Virginia, 2007. A young Matt Lewis blogging at townhall.com in that summer. When some people are predicting that John McCain will exit the race by Labor Day because he is under attack for supporting amnesty. A young Matt Lewis predicts that John McCain very well could win New Hampshire, and if he does, will be the Republican nominee. And it happened.
Great, so I think great moments in punditry.
We may not know much, but we do. I think we are leading the league in our John McCain prediction.
Now, if we can try to extend the streak, you know, there is a lot of chatter about shutdown right now, a lot of attention. Any conservative talking about shutting down the government, holding a continuing resolution or debt ceiling hostage over repealing Obamacare, that's getting a lot of play. But you dig a little deeper in and you don't see that same fervor from the Republican leadership. You have, you know, McConnell is being very agnostic publicly. Boehner is apparently having a meeting today, offering a different path that doesn't involve shutdown, and you have Boehner's chief ally, Tom Cole, going on MSNBC of all places to really rip the shutdown crowd as engaging in political suicide. You have McCain calling it shenanigans to why people hate Washington. It may well be that McCain is effectively McConnell's right-hand man. McCain is doing all the bipartisan dirty work, so McConnell's hands are clean so he can get through his primary versus Matt Bevin's in Kentucky.
I don't think McConnell's a big fan of McCain's, though. It may be happening inadvertently. I don't think
maybe. I mean, obviously they're never simpatico on campaign finance reform, but it seems like McConnell, who's long been an institutionalist, is sort of letting McCain do the work for him to keep the institution humming. So I would not put, you know, high odds on shutdown right now, but a lot of the coverage is about shutdown because any kind of incendiary comment gets the most – attracts all the punditry. And talking about the more mundane probability of things just proceeding as they are because we've avoided shutdowns – plenty over the past 2 years, and there's clearly not a lot of appetite on either side of the aisle for an actual shutdown. You know, that talk, it tends to get less attention. But I do plan to write a piece in the week. It's not published yet. I still gotta write it. I mean, the choice Republicans have to make is, do you have a shutdown this year, or do you try to win the Senate next year? Because you probably can't do both. You really have to run the table to win the Senate back in 2014, and if you do one thing, you know, going off half-cocked, you know, some of these closer races like in Iowa or Louisiana, you know, they're probably going to be in jeopardy if the Republican Party is seen as just being fundamentally unserious about governing. I think that's clearly what's impacting Boehner here. Boehner is clearly worried that they're not going to have a good 2014 if they get caught down a shutdown quagmire. And I just don't know, on the Tea Party side of things, if they're even thinking that far ahead, or they're so hopped up on the notion of burning Washington down, they don't care what happens in 2014. That strikes me as the fundamental choice the party has to face by the end of September.
Well, but they're not – they don't see it that way. They don't see there being any sort of a trade-off. If you're a Tea Party guy, you don't see there being a trade-off between the shutdown and elections. You say this. You say, well, we need to stand on principle and show all the voters, and let's be honest, they're all – it's a center-right nation. We need to show them that we're going to do what we promised to do and stand up for what's right. And will be rewarded for doing that. So they would reject your notion that there's a price tag for, number one, they would reject the notion that there'd be bad press from this, because somehow they're going to win this PR battle. Never happens before, but they'll win this PR battle. And then the public will see that the Republican Party is the one party that's willing to stand up and do what's right on principle. And the public hates Obamacare, which, by the way, they actually do. And so you have to understand they're operating under a different set of assumptions than you are.
I just don't understand why. I mean, I understand standing on principle. Everyone should stand on principle. But why their expression of principle can only be shut down the government if they don't get my way? Like, there's other ways to express one's principle. You could engage in some sort of agreement that has some elements of long-term deficit reduction. That's standing on principle too. So,
they've been told by people they trust that this is the last chance to stop Obamacare, to stop the implementation.
Why that makes no sense. I mean,
matter. Doesn't have to.
I mean, I think people mentioned, if you shut down the government, you don't shut down Obamacare.
I don't want to misrepresent the position. They don't want to shut down the government. If you look at what Heritage Action is saying, and I'm not an expert on the parliamentary procedure stuff, they are saying that you will attach a rider to the continuing resolution, which would specifically ban the use of part of the funds to fund Obamacare. I don't even know if this is possible, technically possible, but I don't want to misrepresent their position. Their position is, we're not going to shut down the government. We don't want to shut down the government. We can defund Obamacare without shutting down the government.
You get the rest of Congress to agree with you and get the president to sign the bill, but that's not going to happen, obviously.
Right. And I would argue that Obama – see, here's part of – I think the thing is they think that they can force Obama to agree to that, because otherwise he would get blamed for shutting down the government, right? But that's ridiculous. Obama – could technically veto a bill which would result in government being shut down because it wouldn't be funded, and Republicans would be blamed. Like, you and I think agree on that point. But they believe that Obama would be blamed because technically he would be the one vetoing the bill that would keep government open otherwise.
I mean, if it was true, I mean, I grant you that the polling for Obamacare is not great. It's not like there's like 70% approval for Obamacare. They love it. They can't wait for it to come. It's obviously a lot more of a mixed picture, leaning negative. But polling for repeal of Obamacare polls terribly. You don't have over 50% support for repeal. Most people are accepting that when we voted for Obama twice, we were going to get something like this, and we're going to wait to see how well it works now before casting final judgment on it. So if you think that by forcing a bill on Obama's desk, which of course would never even get to the Senate in the first place, but or at least by forcing it to the House and forcing Democrats in the Senate to block it or forcing Obama to veto it, that people will reward you. Thank you so much for doing your darndest to repeal Obamacare. I'm so mad that Obama made the government shut down because he wouldn't agree to junking his main legislative achievement. That I just reelected him, knowing full well that was legislative achievement. If that's what you really think is going to happen, you're completely deluding yourself.
I don't know how repeal polls. In fact, I thought that repeal probably polls fairly well, but I do know that defund Obamacare polls poorly. Now, delay Obamacare, according to Crossroads GPS, the Karl Rove outfit that commissioned a poll, delaying its implementation polls better. And there is an argument for this. I mean, Barack Obama unilaterally decided to delay, the employer mandate, which you could argue opens the door for Republicans to say, well, let's delay the individual mandate. Let's delay other implementation. So I think Republicans, again, the interesting thing is this is not a fight on the right. This is not a fight about ideology or philosophy. I mean, I think all Republicans, the vast majority of Republicans, would love to repeal Obamacare. They would love to stop it. It's really a question of strategy and tactics, and an acceptance on the part of some that you can't. This is not a battle you can win. You cannot win the public relations aspect. You could potentially lose Senate seats or House seats over the fight, and potentially make it less likely by virtue of not taking the Senate, that you could eventually actually repeal Obamacare by winning the Senate and winning the presidency and doing it, the right way, as opposed to like some sort of maneuver where you just don't fund it or something. So this is like a legitimate fight over strategy and tactics, not ideology. And yet it's being cast as if you don't support defunding this, you are a part of the surrender caucus. You are a surrender monkey. Now, interestingly, if you look at the people, Tom Coburn thinks this is insane. He's a conservative. You've got people like Byron York, who says you can't defund it. It just can't be done at the D.C. Examiner. He's a conservative. You've got people like Ramesh Panuru, a conservative, who says can't be done. This is a bad idea. But still in all, there's some very powerful voices, conservative voices, who essentially have set it up that you're either a traitor or a wimp if you don't push to defund.
It's just so bizarre to me. I mean, if you're really convinced that it's going to be a disaster, you could just let it be a disaster for a couple years and then run on it then and say you're going to repeal it. It seems to me the bigger fear is that they're afraid it gets implemented and it won't be a disaster. People might like it, and they're stuck with it forever. But it just seems like even John McCain's out there saying, "Look, it's not going to get repealed today. The votes just aren't there. You're never going to get Democrats to repeal it. You didn't get Barack Obama to willfully junk his own plan that he's invested his entire presidential legacy on." It's not going to happen. So it's not going to change till 2016, no matter what. So why not just play for 2016 and see what else you can get out of a negotiation? I mean, Tom Coburn, this is the guy who is like singularly obsessed about debt, and is saying, let's see what I can get to reduce debt in this deal so we actually don't have a big debt.
If you look at Byron York and David Drucker, these reporters for the DC Examiner, they've interviewed staffers who work for members who are supporting the fund. And of course they're anonymous sources, but these are professional and respected reporters, and I trust, that these are legitimate sources who are just protecting their identity, who say, look, we know we can't defund it, but we need to do this on principle. We need to send a message. We need to, whatever. And so even the people pushing for this, if you believe, Byron York and David Drucker, the sources they quote, they even concede, well, this is like a game, but they believe that it's a game that helps them in terms of public relations, in terms of demonstrating to the public that they're serious, and that's where I think they're delusional, because I don't think this fight, you know, having this sort of brinksmanship over shutting down the government is a winner from a public relations standpoint. It's just my opinion. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
When you read the coverage about it now, it doesn't read like Republicans gloriously trying to save the country from a healthcare debacle. It reads like governments can't freaking wait to shut down the government. They love shutting down government.
And this is true for a variety of reasons. Like, number one, the president has the bully pulpit, and so he will be able to have a coordinated message where we will be the right, Republicans will be off message. Number two, we've got a liberal press, and I think they love Obama, and they're gonna portray it that way. And number three, there's a built-in skew where people assume that the Republican Party is the anti-government party, and therefore they cannot wait to shut down government. And so I always assume that in cases like this, the PR thing will go against Republicans. I guess, you know, the thing, I was happy to see that the sequester story, even though there was some bad press, you know, I think you got to say Republicans won that battle because nothing bad happened and the deficit is going down. I mean, I'm sure some people were hurt, don't get me wrong, but by and large, there wasn't a catastrophe. But I don't even know the Republicans got that much credit for it, even though I think they were right on
the
merits.
Well, the press is sort of weird because both parties' messaging is very convoluted around it, because people want to take credit for the deficit reducer, they don't want to take credit for the cuts, at least on the Democratic side. And on the Republican side, they don't want to pretend the deficit's going down, they want to pretend that they want to act like it's still going up.
Right, so nobody
can. And they don't want to take credit for specific cuts.
It's an insane world. And Bill, this brings us full circle, because this is why I want to go on vacation. This kind of stuff is why I need to get away from this kind of stuff, because it is insanity.
Perhaps we should end it on that note, sir.
Yes, indeed. Good conversation as always.
As always, you're gonna have a respite next week?
No. I'll be back next week.
Okay.
And then I'm off. And then you're off, I think, after that.
Right.
So
I'm off the week of the 19th.
All right. So I'm off the week of the 12th. So we'll both be back here next week in the DMZ. See you then.